In this age, where some 6 billion human beings occupy the planet Earth, some 300 million of them residing in a territory referred to internally as the United States of America, and externally as those arrogant sons of bitches who think they can be the world's policemen, but despite being ranked 5th in the World's Cup, can't even manage to win a soccer match against Ghana, there remains a troubling predicament. With so many Homo sapiens occupying this strange planet, how can anyone be declared special? This strange race of people, who often massacre each other in senseless genocides and get obsessed with rote popularity contests known as reality TV, often attempt to solve this conundrum by watering and mowing their lawns, maxing out their credit cards and purchasing meaningless products, and consuming more resources than they probably should. This results sometimes in a strange entropy, with all sorts of unresolved questions. Some speculate upon the weather, uttering remarks like, "My, it's going to be a scorcher," and clutch onto this as a conversational topic that is amicable and inoffensive. Others speculate upon the lack of human innovation with regards to women's clothing, where men are given rectilinear business suits perfectly tailored to their angular forms that they may often wear twice or more. Women, by contrast, are still waiting for sartorial innovation to catch up with their anatomical curves, hoping for the fateful day where they can wear a dress twice without fear of public retribution. As might be gathered by this rhetoric, thinking about distinctions often results in crass generalizations, which is why our regular host can't make it this week. That Segundo cannot generalize and be crass at the same time, and besides, he needed a day off. Which leaves me, an out-of-work philosopher collecting unemployment checks to fill in the pivotal details, or at least pad this podcast out. Hopefully, my services have sufficiently inspired you for the conversation that will now transpire. But if they haven't, and I have proven incompetent, I am happy to submit my corpus for a public flogging. Assuming, of course, that enough of the listeners here possess the appropriate administrative skills to arrange for the cudgels, the tar and feathers, and the pounding of painful nails into sticks with which to scrape my tender and highly sensitive skin. Okay, so I am here with Hal Nidvieski, who is the author of Hello, I'm Special, but also an editor, a journalist, a commentator, a fiction writer. I'm sure there's some other things.
I think that's about everything.
Really, no. Short order
lover,
cook.
Lover.
Okay, yeah, well, also Canadian, but we won't hold that against you. But the first thing I wanted to ask you is, what do you Canadians have against American culture? We've got you, Naomi Klein, Marshall McLuhan. What's up with that?
Well, I mean, I think the best cultural commentary comes from, you know, the outside looking in, but not too far outside. And so, obviously, and this isn't a new idea, but Canada is a good place to observe and also to feel the pull of empire and feel the kind of desire being implanted in us by something that is other. Which I think is really what pop culture and consumer culture and mass culture are all about. So it's not shocking to, you know, discover that Canadians sometimes come up with a good twist on things, you know.
Certainly. Well, let's talk about this twist sort of briefly, and then we'll go get into the nitty-gritty. You maintain that individualism is the new conformity. Not the new black, but maybe you can sort of kind of underline this point. Because for someone kind of who isn't aware of this book, a nonconformist or conformist nonconformist is sort of going to be a little bit of an oxymoron for them.
Sure. Well, I mean, as you said, that's the basic premise of the book. Conformity is something now that instills in us a rebellious attitude in which we, you know, try to show our opposition to a mainstream. And so I ask in the book, well, what happens in a world where everyone is opposed to the mainstream, and in fact the message of the mainstream is you must oppose the mainstream. That's, you know, to me that's what's happening in our society. And so I kind of try to chart that terrain in the book by looking for, first trying to prove this hypothesis, finding as many examples as I can of a mainstream culture that relentlessly peddles the idea of us being nonconformist and special, and then charting the impact of that idea on things like family or religion or nationalism and, you know, really every aspect of our lives.
But one might also argue, though, that a individual choice is inherently going to be a conformist choice, given that someone else is going to do it. Someone else is going to choose a band to listen to or, you know, wear a particular T-shirt, even if it's totally arcane or obscure.
Right.
So, I mean, isn't there any room for a gray area with this dichotomy?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of gray in this discussion, in the whole idea of, you know, of rebellion as a conformist position. And, you know, I mean, there's a lot of what I say in the book. It has been said before, where the book becomes original material is not so much in that idea, but in the fact that it's now actually happening. And a lot of authors kind of hypothesized that this would happen, but now it's actually happening, and so this is a very concrete book with kind of less gray than you would think, you know, because you can actually point to all these people and phenomena and traditions and cultural values that are changing right in front of us as people seek specialness. Which isn't to say that you know, human behavior and our inherent desire to be noticed for who we are, you know, is always gray. There's always, you know, it's always muddy and foggy and confused, and one minute you say something and the next minute you do the exact opposite. And that's part of why I love to talk to people and write about these issues.
But I suppose, though, I mean, what's wrong with being a conformist? I mean, like, for example, hey, I like clap your hands, say yeah, yeah, but so does, like, you know, thousands of other people. You know, I have no problem. I mean, what to the person who sort of lives a kind of humble or self-effacing life where they don't really care if they conform or not? I mean, this kind of, in fact, actually, like Joe Wiebe, one of your reviews sort of suggested that this book simply boils down to the question, are you special? But for someone for who that's a moot point, why is this issue important?
Right. Well, I mean, I don't think that it is a moot point for anybody anymore because of this social pressure that we see in really every context of society, which is be yourself, seize the day, you know, achieve your dream. And so it's a very kind of dehumanizing, pressure-filled position to be in because you want to go about your daily life and not, you know, not have this pressure on you, and yet you feel constantly assaulted to be more than you are. So if you are, you know, living a kind of what is a classically conformist existence as, you know, a middle manager at a advertising firm, or you sell insurance or whatever, and you have two kids, and you go and you're a deacon at the local church, and, you know, all those things are diminished by this message, which is, you know, but you're not being yourself, and you're not rebelling against these horrible things, the church and the insurance industry and the small town values you're being sucked into. And so we see again and again in the interviews that I do with people and in how traditions try to shift to make people feel more special, that there is this almost this agony and uncertainty in people now. Well, you know, this used to be what I was supposed to do, and I should be happy. So why am I so miserable? And why do I feel like I should be writing a novel and blogging and, you know, reinventing myself, getting tattoos, you know, and all these things?
But there are people who are perfectly happy working those middle management positions, selling insurance, going to the suburban home. You know, they don't care, perhaps, or maybe they find a sort of comfort in not being so distinct. Hmm. What of that, then?
Well, I mean, you know, are they perfectly happy? Is anyone perfectly happy? I mean, we're really looking at a big social trend where, for instance, if I go to a high school, and, you know, this isn't hypothetical, I've done this, and you say, well, who wants to be a doctor? Who wants to be a fireman? You know, who wants to be a homemaker? You know, whatever. Nobody wants to be those things. You say, well, who wants to be a pop star? Everybody. Who wants to be a movie star? Everybody. Who wants to be a professional athlete? Everybody. Who wants to be a tycoon? Everybody. Right? So there's this ongoing pressure that clearly has seeped into the, you know, the education system and what kids think is success. And success is not so much monetary anymore. It's more measured in the extent to which you've become a sort of virtual character, an extension of yourself who's reinvented and wanted and considered endlessly cool. And I mean, you're right. There are people who are immured to this, who can shut it off. But those people are less and less. And as our societies, or not our society, as our communities decline, and we have fewer and fewer avenues to recognize the inherent, you know, individuality of any single person, you feel more and more like you have no choice but to sell yourself and invent yourself, and it becomes, you know, something that you know, it's like sink or swim. You know, you can't even achieve middle managerness without, you know, claiming to be a bad boy middle manager, you know?
Well, at the same time, though, I mean, let's take this sort of hypothetical kind of student who goes through high school and essentially wants to be the pop star. Well, during the course of, like, that particular student's life, as the student grows up and, you know, goes through their 20s, they're going to sort of come close to maybe what they actually end up doing. Hmm. I mean, I don't know, it just seems to me that if you're a conformist or a nonconformist, it seems to be almost too easy a label for the sort of great kind of variables of life here, you know?
Right. Well, yeah, again, I mean, this is, you know, the book itself, I think, is much more ambiguous and you know, in this gray terrain than the title. I mean, you have this sociological phenomenon, and it doesn't encompass every single person in every situation. However, again, you know, the big trend is that's one of the things that people say as a sort of counter argument. Well, people grow up and they grow out of it, but when I look at what's happening in our society and the people I've talked to from all the many different age groups, they don't grow up and they don't grow out of it. And if you go down to, you know, the idol tryouts, you'll find, you know, 35-year-olds claiming to be 25 and 14-year-olds claiming to be 16, and they all have the exact same idea and the same kind of passion for their specialness, their same utter lack of talent, you know. And so obviously there's something in society that brings all these people to the same point in their lives. You know, and then I go and talk to a successful family man who started his own, you know, internet design business and should be feeling pretty good about things, and he's not. You know, he wants to blow it all up. He's 32 or whatever. Like you say, he should have gotten over it and found his thing. But he wants to blow it all up and start, you know, an ultra hip men's magazine. Because what he's doing is not, you know, perceived by him and by the society at large to be special enough.
But not everybody, like, for example, you take karaoke to task. Not everybody goes to karaoke, for example, with the idea of being special. They just go there to have fun, or they just go there to... Not every single 45-year-old person is going to be clinging on to some sort of lost dream.
No, of course not. Of course not. And again, it's in gradations, right? Mm-hmm. Not every single person has that, you know, goes to karaoke every night, sings the same songs, and, you know, and has this very pathetic "Hello, I'm Special" fantasy. But I think most people who have done karaoke close their eyes for a minute and imagine that they're famous, you know, and that's part of the reason it's such a successful thing, is that you have the audience and you have the song and you inhabit this creature for a few minutes, for a few seconds, whatever it is, and you know, you don't go there and sing your own songs, you don't go there and say, I'm forming a meaningful community where we're all, you know, getting together and singing our community anthems and, you know, knowing each other and having fun. You go there so that everyone can look at you and, you know, you have somewhere, some place in your life where everyone can look at you, even for just a minute, and you can imagine that you're a star. And there's gradations of that, but I think that's the essential reality of what people do when they go to karaoke.
But let's go ahead and say, I mean, you know, we've all had that kind of impulse. I've had that minor impulse, but I'm not going to necessarily cling to it as if it's sort of my kind of life's destiny to become right. the next American Idol person. It's more of, you know, it's more like theater. It's like going in, I'm in the Shakespeare play, and I am inhabiting sort of, you know, Hamlet or something mm-hmm. in a community theater production. It's no different from that, one might argue, you know?
But what you choose to inhabit and how you inhabit it, your fantasy life, says a lot about our culture and our society. And, you know, that to me, the success of something like karaoke and its various spin-offs, like movie karaoke, you know, and then the incredible obsession with kind of prefab pop music, like the Idol shows and on into reality TV and Top Model and all these things, they all indicate this incredible desire by people to have some access to the machinery of fame, which can make them famous and make them feel special, even though they know at the same time that they will never be famous. They are not going to be Madonna. So I think people are really kind of, they're like bipolar right now. People aren't stupid, and they realize they're being manipulated and that, you know, their fame is very unlikely. At the same time, they're drawn to it like moths to the light, and this, I think, is very much human nature.
But maybe it's also a matter of, like, vegging out or watching some trash television or just having a sort of, like, experience that people realize is not going to be their sort of life's ambition. Your thesis kind of also suggests that people are kind of inhabiting this dream or clinging onto it. And I guess I sort of, you know, I'm trying to kind of find out the gray area here.
Right. Well, really, I mean, people are definitely inhabiting this dream and clinging to it and making radical changes in their life. And, you know, the book is filled with these people. And, you know, that's how I come to the thesis, right? Of you know, that there is the extreme. There are the extreme people who do this, who will line up for, you know, 4 days so they can have their idol tryout, or they're slowly turning themselves into a lizard via plastic surgery and tattoos and piercings. Or they're, you know, doing more and more extreme things, or backyard wrestling and Elvis impersonations, and you know, and then there's this entire world of kind of people who exist to facilitate your sense of specialness, personalized preachers, personalized everything, basically. You know, it's in our society, and people are responding to it and doing it. You know, of course we can find many people who we would say, well, they're not affected to it. But then again, if you sit down and talk to them, I often find that they are in some way. If you know, that this is one of those things that is expressed in our culture. I mean, you can say, okay, people just sit down and veg out on TV, but, you know, what are they watching? Why is it being made for them in this way? What is it about the pseudo-interactive, you know, you're America, you are choosing the next Top Model, you know, you call in. What is it about that kind of television that is so compelling now? You know, if they were just sitting and vegging out, then why aren't we just showing reruns of The Love Boat or whatever? You know, like there's messages to be seen from our pop culture, I think.
Well, in your mind, is the question of being special more tied into ego or integrity? Or maybe you can sort of talk about this, because I mean, you frequently refer to in this book the sort of nature of being I'm specialness or and all that. And I was wondering if you could sort of describe specifically what you mean. Is it unique? Is being unique?
Right. Well, it's, I mean, special is kind of the word I came up with to define this new sense of entitlement, which is basically, you know, I am entitled to be noticed in my society in a kind of virtual way, which is to say, I should be more than I am. I should be something more like a celebrity. And celebrity, I think, is the pinnacle in our society now. And that's, you know, that's when people, and yet, you know, we can, very few of us can actually be celebrities. And so there's this kind of, you know, low-grade celebrity which is emerging, which is kind of specialness, you know, and people will seek specialness in their smaller communities and societies by doing crazy things, and on up the ladder. I mean, is it, it's not conventional kind of egomania as a sort of psychiatric, you know, understanding. It's something much more about, I think, playing on the on what was once an inherent value in a community. Certainly, well, since the Enlightenment and since we developed these ideas that everyone, you know, is worth something, and that, you know, entire races and families and castes are not, you know, total garbage, you know. But, you know, all communities, I think, had a way to assert people's individualism, and we're, as we lose that in bigger and bigger kind of mass market post-industrial communities in which, you know, the as I said, the iconographic achievement is celebrity, which is a kind of anti-person, a person that doesn't really exist. That's, we all want to become that. We want to become the person that doesn't exist.
So I take it you're an Ortega y Gasset fan.
Say again?
I take it that you're an Ortega y Gasset fan then.
I'm not sure. I don't think I've
well, they're all bold to the masses, elitism.
Well,
I mean, is this tied into elitism, your notion of, like, well, certain people are worth more than others? Or,
right. Well, I mean, that's definitely put out there in our culture, and people definitely believe that, that, you know, that certain people have achieved what everyone else wants, and those, you know, Donald Trump was talking about, there's an interview with him, I think it was in the New York Times Magazine, and he was saying how the other billionaires are jealous of him, because when he walks down the street, everyone is like, Donald, hey, Donald, you're the man. But when the other billionaires walk down the street, they're not recognized. People don't know who they are. And so he's achieved more than them, right?
Yeah.
Because he's not just a billionaire or whatever. He's also achieved the heights of celebrity. And I think that to me is kind of, you know, the message of our society, that it's like, money aside, that's all well and good, but it's like this virtual recognition. That's what we feed on. That's what makes us excited. And I think that really comes out of a dearth of opportunities, like grassroots, kind of holistic opportunities in our lives to feel recognized for who we are, as opposed to, you know, what kind of virtual stunt we've pulled off that propels us into a museum or on TV or in a magazine or in the newspaper.
Well, you also take to task Found Magazine, which I would actually argue is, I think maybe in that case, people sort of recognize the fact that it has these sort of quotidian details.
Right.
And if that were sort of the judgment of art or something to read, well, we'll have to go ahead and take away Nicholson Baker, we'll have to take away Harvey Peacock.
Right. Well, I mean, I don't think I take Found Magazine to task. I talk about it as part of this phenomena. And, you know, and a lot of the things you're talking about, like Peacock and all this obsessive autobiographical material, is part of this, you know, this phenomena of specialness. But in the case of Found, I mean, I think what I'm interested in, is, in part, is the way in which kind of mainstream marketing culture and what it puts out there, and what something that started out as a kind of underground movement, like a Found magazine thing, how they've morphed, they've become the same thing, which is this all this kind of serendipitous kind of interplay between quirky humanity and weirdness. And and so, you know, in the case of Found, it starts as the zine, and then it becomes, you know, ends up on Letterman and you know, in and flying to, you know, Italy, whatever, to address academics or whatever, you know. You know, the values of the two cultures have become sort of the same. Like, the message of Found is, in its own really delightful way, and I do admire the project, is, you know, everyone's special, everyone's great, everyone deserves to be kind of looked at, even the most anonymous note from some dumb teenage girl, you know, has its place and is representative of this great melting pot of humanity on our earth. And that, in many ways, is also now the main message of all of mass culture, you know.
But none of this is Found's fault, though. I mean, it's
I don't blame Found. I just use it as an example. None of this is anybody's fault, you know.
I mean, is it really sort of fair, like, to call something either selling out? I mean, like, Dave Eggers wrote that sort of, like, you know, little thing on selling out,
right?
Pertaining to the Flaming Lips, in which he said, "Well, yes, they've become a financial success, but look at this sort of experimental stuff that they've done before
right.
that."
Right.
You know,
I'm not talking at all about selling out. Selling out doesn't exist. It's a total kind of fabrication that, again, perpetuates this myth that we're rebelling against the man. And then we get bought up by the man and we sell out. You know, I wrote a lot about that in my previous book, We Want Some Too.
Yeah.
And what I've basically concluded is that there's no underground, there's no alternative, because there's no mainstream, because the values of both are the same, and, you know, it's really an anything goes society, and the emphasis is simply you. You know, how can you get yourself noticed and put something out there? And you know, in that context, there can't be a mainstream or an underground. The mainstream will sell anything, adopt anything, whether it's songs about cop killers or porn or, you know, deviant sex or violence, whatever it is, you know, the mainstream will adopt it and put it on as long as it can be shown to be profitable. And within that context, I don't know what you could possibly call alternative, you know. And so I've concluded that there is no such thing as an alternative.
But isn't this sort of an inevitable part of the process? Something like, take for example, like a novelist like William T. Bowman, who started
right.
off very underground. Now he's won the National Book Award. But, you know, the guy has been writing continuously for, like, you know, 20 years mm-hmm. and turning out books left and right. And he hasn't really compromised his own sort of, I guess, uniqueness or his distinctness.
Right, right. But his distinctness does not come from his the fact that he is aesthetically inhospitable and inadmissible to the mainstream. His distinctness becomes from what he is as an artist and a creator, and that is sort of you know, has nothing to do with the underground or being alternative. It has to do with, you know, someone who's works hard, is an obsessive thinker and writer, and has produced 30, 40 books, and, you know, and achieved, you know, some very interesting things with his writing. You know, we may fantasize that he is an underground figure who has been discovered by the mainstream but kept it real.
Yeah.
But in truth, there's nothing in his books, from the perspective of ideology or his aesthetic, that, you know, that the mainstream wouldn't be happy to put out there if shown to be, you know, successful.
Well, you haven't read Horse for Gloria, which has some pretty brutal stuff that is in the vein. You're basically sort of suggesting that the mainstream will, that it's more a matter of the relationship between the mainstream and the underground and the reception. I mean, you're saying, sort of suggesting that the mainstream media will just essentially take anything? Is that?
I'm saying that there really is no such thing as a mainstream media or an underground anymore. That the two things, the only thing that separates the two is economic opportunity. And, you know, what we understand to be the mainstream is a series of kind of corporate conglomerates who control our access to the mass media. That's the mainstream. Aesthetically, however, they don't care what actually they put out there as long as it makes them money. And so, you know, people have this fantasy, and the fantasy is, I'm too dangerous for the man. I'm too hot for TV. I'm too crazy to be on, you know, to put out a CD with Warner or whatever. But that's just not the case. You know, if you can build a following and a market and prove to them that you will sell X number of units, then they'll put you on, you know. And within that context, there is no, you know, there's no radicalism as we understand it, that, you know, we used to have this in society. We had a mainstream culture that would not talk about certain things, or portray certain images or ideas. We don't have that anymore.
Well, I beg to differ, because we haven't seen any of the soldiers from Iraq or you know, come back. We haven't seen any of the carnage from the Iraq War on any of the mainstream media outlets, or any of the media outlets, really, aside from, you know, obscure sort of sites. That's
because they don't, it doesn't sell. They've determined that that is not creating a positive marketing environment.
So the act of being special, then, you're talking about economics, then?
Well, I mean, economics are always in play in our you know, highly capitalist society. I would say that the act of being special is in many ways an act of selling yourself. And really, you know, again, the ultimate is celebrity. A celebrity is someone who makes money and lives a wonderful life just by being themselves, seemingly without doing anything. And that, you know, that's the pinnacle. That's what we all want to achieve. You know, and people go forward imagining themselves in different scenarios. How can they achieve that pinnacle? So it is, I mean, it is an economic thing. For instance, if you go and, you know, kind of ask people who are, you know, working in a bank or whatever, and they have this fantasy of achieving something else, you know, that fantasy rarely has to do with the long hours of solitude that you would put in to become, you know, an amazing painter. You know they say, well, I'm going to be a famous painter, and that's my dream. But, you know, the dream is kind of the image of a painter. The dream is not, you know, hundreds of hours of solitude learning your craft or whatever. And again, it's this kind of weird fantasy of instant achievement through reinvention as someone special.
Well, I agree with that, but I'm guessing where I'm starting, I'm just trying to understand, like, say you offer something that you are very passionate or very talented at, mm-hmm. that is not particularly economically feasible.
Right.
Is this person, would this person then be sort of legitimately sort of special or legitimately individual?
Well, can't, yeah, is there a legitimate specialness?
Well, that's what
part
I'm
of
trying to determine
that's
here,
part
yeah.
of what the book keeps asking, and I go on these sort of quests to look for legitimate specialness. And of course, one thing that keeps coming up over and over again is those who are legitimately special now can only show their specialness by completely retreating from a society in which everyone seeks to be special. So how do you prove you're really special? By refusing to seek specialness. You know, so I go out to, for instance, the Gulf Islands of British Columbia, where traditionally the kind of weirdest people have gone, and the hippies went in the 60s and 70s, and communes, and, you know, and people basically go to flee society. And a lot of the people I find there are those kind of people who are saying, well, you know, I have to keep going further and further in the age of special. I have to retreat further and further from this society, because it's like sucking the specialness out of me. And a lot of them is fascinating because they'll say, well, even here, it's not, I haven't gone, I can't retreat far enough. And they want to go to further islands, and, but there's nowhere really left to go because everywhere now there's like some, you know, German billionaire who's building a mansion on their, you know, on their island, which has no electricity and no boat access, but still the German billionaire loves it, you know, and has bought half of it. Is there a unique specialness? I don't think in the terms that we understand it, where if we're caught up in this idea of kind of underground and mainstream, and who is legitimately not selling out, and who is legitimately edgy. I don't think we can find the answer to that question with that, as long as we cling to that dichotomy, which I think is just completely. A completely false dichotomy now that it doesn't exist for all the reasons we've just discussed. And people might disagree or whatever, but that's my analysis of the situation. I think maybe we'll come back to this. I don't know. there is a lot to be said for how we can return individuality and individualism to people outside of specialism. So I don't know if you want to get into that
now,
it's kind of like the end in a way.
Oh, well.
It's the end of the book, you know?
Well, you were mentioning earlier, and this one actual metaphor that actually struck me, and that is sort of, there is no more territory to wander in. There is no more sort of territory to sort of explore.
Mm-hmm.
All the land has been occupied. You were mentioning the German billionaires
right.
with their homes. I'm wondering why you feel that humans who are, you know, naturally, I think, inventive, I would think, are so, you know, I guess, in your view, not willing to explore further sort of depths, like the depths of the ocean, perhaps, or the depths of space.
Right, right.
I mean, you know, there's always something to find out about.
Absolutely, and people are doing that, and that, you know, if you look at the culture of exploration and, like, radical treks and, you know, to be the first person to go up Everest 10 times in a row.
Yeah.
Or, you know, the bar keeps getting raised, right? Or to go to be farther down in the ocean than anybody, or be, you know, to be the first country that has built this entire, you know, space world and, you know. But, I mean, there's this obsession with these radical acts that very much mirrors the pattern of specialness, which is like, you know, in a time when there's very little we can do to say we're special, then, you know, obviously one of the answers to that is to achieve these incredibly insane, dangerous things. And we see a culture of that, of these guys who, you know, and of course, to do those things, you have to have a lot of time and a lot of money. And so it's mostly these millionaires, you know, like the guy who owns Virgin or whatever, who do these incredible stunts, and they're, you know, I'm going to fly around the world 50 times, or I'm going to do these things. And I don't think it has a lot to do with my faith in the human desire to explore.
Yeah.
Because, you know, with a few exceptions, like space and like the ocean, which, let's face it, are really beyond just about everybody's possibilities. You can't get up there unless you're, you know, that, you know, there's the Russian billionaire or whatever who paid Russia fly him up there. But, you know, there's smaller scale things like, I'm going to be the first guy to crawl across this desert. You know, that's never been done before, and people do that stuff. And there's this whole culture of extreme travel that emerges from that, which I think is directly related to what we've been talking about all along, which is like, what can I do to reinvent myself and to make me noticed and put myself into this virtual world? And obviously, if you're in the record books as the first person who crawled across the Sahara, you know, drinking only the juice of cactus, that's a way to get special.
But what if, like, sort of, I guess, figures in history who were just, like, you know, above and beyond, sort of, like, you know, so totally distinct?
Right.
I mean, you're contending that is, you know, Beethoven, Mozart, Martin Luther King,
right.
Sayonara, you know, you're not special. Is that what you're basically
saying? No, that's not what I'm saying at all. I mean, you know,
are you applying this more to a sort of, like, you know, populist kind of mentality? Or?
There's two different issues here, yeah. right? Yeah. I mean, if we want to talk about how to contextualize true genius and talent
yeah.
within a culture of special, am I personally denying that there, you know, that there is true genius and talent? Not at all. I am saying that in our culture, that is genius is very much devalued because everyone basically says, well, I could be a genius, you know. I'm special too. And within that context, it becomes harder and harder to actually notice and celebrate those who really are incredibly talented at what they do, whether they're a brain surgeon or a painter or a singer. Those people still exist. It's just that our culture kind of, at the same time, puts them on this ridiculous pedestal while also completely diminishing actual achievement, right? And that's why I'm not talking about genius, I'm talking about celebrity, you know? Some geniuses become celebrity,
yeah.
and, you know, and that is part of the conundrum of many people is, I have an actual talent and skill that I believe in. How do I achieve that without being sucked into the culture of special and having whatever, you know, whatever sort of impulse I have to community building, to making the world a better place, turned into a Gap commercial? That's increasingly hard to do when we get back to people saying, fuck it, I can't do it, I'm going to withdraw. And so you have famous figures who have famously completely withdrawn from society.
Yeah, yeah.
So yes, there is an inherent, you know, I certainly believe in genius, and I also believe that if we had a more open system of by which we can communicate each other through the electronic media, more people would have a voice, but the true geniuses and the true talents would rise to the fore in our communities without becoming kind of parodies of themselves, which is, you know, again, a sort of complicated idea, but it's one of the solutions I see to this problem. Because the
by open system, what do you mean exactly?
Say again?
By open system, what do you mean exactly?
Well, I mean, what I really mean is, if you wanted your own TV show, you should have it. If you wanted, you know, we're sort of achieving that on the internet, and that's what we're doing here with this podcast and all the blogs and all that kind of thing. But the whole thing is sort of horribly tainted by these concepts we have of celebrity, underground culture, and all these myths that change what we're really doing, which is creating kind of community nodules by which we can talk to each other, which is the kind of open system that I envision. And people say to me, if everybody could have their own TV show, then my God, it would be horrible, right? Because what would we watch?
Yeah.
We wouldn't know what to watch. It would all suck, basically. And to which I have two answers. One is, like, how can it be worse than it is now? And two, yes, a lot of it will suck, but people and communities and societies will naturally gravitate to those things that are meaningful, that provide context and information about their local community, and are those things that truly rise above the fore. And so it would be kind of a holistic grassroots, you know, gathering of people who say, hey, wait a minute, the thing this guy is doing is, you know, way better than what everyone else is doing, and so we're going to tune into that. And I think that we do have examples of that. We do see that in blog culture, in podcasting, to some extent on like cable access, and as opposed to the way it is now, where you take a perfectly random person, a Britney Spears, with no discernible talent whatsoever, and
except for,
you know,
babies, she's very good at that.
Yeah, yeah. And you give them unfettered access to the mass media, and you create, you know, every aspect of their image, and they become a celebrity. And that, you know, what does that say to people? That says to people, hey, where am I in this? Why aren't I special too? You know? and you really don't have an answer for that, because you could be special too if you were the one who won that lottery and was chosen.
But let's say we went ahead and did this and had this sort of mass democratization of the of art and culture and things like that. We're still describing the exact same thing of people kind of gravitating towards specific things, and then people with money sort of saying, oh, well, this particular show, for example, gets a lot of ratings. Maybe we should just totally, like, you know, up the advertising rates, etc.
Right. Well,
so
that,
you,
I mean...
And you fought into this kind of, like, circular sort of...
this is our problem. Yeah, we need to remove, you know, the inherent right of community to communicate to each other from the capitalist structure of kind of... of network broadcasting, you know. Clear Channel should not own 59% of all the radio stations in America, you know. Five companies should not own, you know, every TV network and you know, the vast majority of the movie and production and, you know, and pop song. It's, and, you know, we need to break that up. And again, that's not a new idea, right? The media media conformity is destroying community. That's not a new idea. But, you know, what I'm saying is not anti-pop culture. I'm not, you know, in which I define pop culture really as that which is kind of instantaneously reproduced through electronic means. You know, that's really what popular culture is. A lot of these critics are anti-pop culture, right? And they say, well, it's the fine arts that matter. And, you know, I'm not interested in that at all. Like, fine arts, fine. If you want to do that, that's great. I'm saying that our, you know, our inherent instinct to be noticed is can be played out in all kinds of funny pop culture ways. It's just that we need to remove the perversion of celebrity from that concept. You know, so you do your thing, you're part of your community, you're noticed in your community, you have meaning in your life by being recognized in your community, and those who are truly talented and truly, you know, a cut above the others, rise out of their communities and maybe achieve regional, national, international stature. Like, I don't have a problem with that, you know, in this kind of hypothetical utopian world, which, frankly, you know, I cannot really imagine how we're actually going to get there, you know, but I can imagine, you know, some of it, some of how it might work.
Well, we have to start kind of wrapping this up, but I wanted to kind of get into some of the other points.
Sure.
Organized religion, for example, you take on, and you sort of point out that traditional religion, well, at least when you wrote this book, wasn't really sort of seriously threatened. But let's go ahead and talk of the success of Passion of the Christ.
Mm-hmm,
talk of the way the whole anti-gay issues was played out in the 2004 election, which allowed Bush to sort of gain those states.
Sure.
Let's talk about, like, you know, we had actually a couple of weeks ago this Christian revolutionist, or, you know, revisionist group, Battle Cry. You know, there's a number of sort of really serious kind of fundamental sort of streaks flowing through this country right
now. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And I address that in the book. And what I mean, the way I see it, okay, I mean, we have this, the conventional belief is that religion is on the rise in America. In fact, that's not true. That, in fact, if you actually look at the numbers, people who identify themselves with a kind of traditional organized religion, that number of people continues to decline. The spike, which is not enough to counteract those who are declining, is in fundamentalist Christianity that you're just describing. What's interesting about that, of course, is that much of this fundamentalist Christianity is pitched as a show. It's pitched as being about you and kind of your needs, and you're going to achieve the rapture and you're going to go to heaven, and it's very much about you, and it's quite different from the kind of traditional religion that, you know, we see in the synagogue or the church. I mean, you've got these guys driving a a Harley Davidson custom painted with a crown of thorns and called the Passion, and he's driving this across, you know, the stage of the MCI Center or wherever, to the thunderous roar of 20,000 people. And so this fundamentalist Christianity, I think, has succeeded by tapping into the kind of basest zeitgeist of specialism, which is, you know, I am lost in this world. I have no community. I have no tradition. All I have is this desire to be noticed and recognized. Conventional religion isn't doing it. So if you are going to go that route, you're going to go to the fundamentalists, because they're the ones who are saying, you know, you can really achieve your specialness with us. And we recognize that, and we will, you know, give you all that attention that you need, that you're not getting in your conventional Catholic religion, where, you know, the priest mumbles something in Latin and you take the host and you're out of there, you know.
Well, but to take the sort of the idea of battle cry, them coming to the city because they wanted to sort of protest anti-gay relationships, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you know, this seemed a very kind of, let's go ahead and collect the masses together and speak one sort of true conformist message,
right,
that
we
must all believe in. So, you know, this is a very fundamentalist operation. It's a very conformist operation that still, nevertheless, has its audience. So are we talking about, like, you know, two forms of conformity when it comes to religion?
Well, we're getting into a very ironic aspect of the rise of specialism, which we've already touched on, which is a lot of people are very frightened, very lost in our society, because we don't have traditional community structures that can give them a place. And in the absence of those things, they're looking for new things. In the book, I say, okay, what are those new things? One of them is this sort of whole pop culture world where they become bloggers, or they become Elvis impersonators, or they develop an obsession with collecting Barbie dolls. They go to the Barbie doll forum and the Barbie doll convention, and that provides them with what I think of as a kind of neo-pop culture identity, a new kind of community that they can be in. The other way is to find something like a fundamentalist religion or a cult that's going to, again, provide you with a neo-community that's going to be, you know, you have a niche, you have a place, you are there because God wants you there, you are here with us, you know, because everything is defined in the Bible, and that is another way for you to feel special and outside of the oppressive void of having to continually reinvent yourself. So whether you're, you know, Massachusetts' number one Barbie doll collector, or you're, you know, the number one fan of Jesus Christ and this particular whatever religion, you know, it functions in the same way. And so we're seeing these neo communities. But again, you know, if you actually look at the statistics of kind of, you know, the census that charts religion and all that, way, way, way more people are moving toward the pop culture world to articulate their specialness than this religious world. But those people who are moving toward the religious world are incredibly vocal and incredibly savvy at getting their message across, because they're pressing the buttons of society, which we all feel, which is the decline of tradition, the lack of any moral imperative, the inability of us to say this is bad and this is good. Because again, you know, if your society says your highest achievement is celebrity is amoral. It is neither bad nor good. It is neither of talent or not talent. And so we float in this amoral void, and, you know, people seek to fill that void. And one of those ways is, you know, neo-fundamentalist community. And you know, you see that with the Jewish religion, where the only growth is in the ultra-orthodox. And you see that in these radical fundamentalist groups.
But one might also argue that both specialization and a sort of conformist religious kind of thing both kind of appeal to the ego, which is, you know, I mean, even if you were to get rid of the notion of being special, you would still have the human ego to deal with. Everyone mm-hmm. has some sort of, like, you know, would like to have be appealed to directly, you know?
Yeah. No, I mean, the, you know, we have our natural human impulse, which, again, is I need to be noticed. I can't, I'm not just a, you know, an ant doing my work on this earth. I need to be loved. I need to be in a family. I need to be in a community. That community needs to be in a society, and I need to have clear mechanisms by which, you know, my ego impulse can be felt, you know, whether that's in a job, in a religion, in a relationship. What happens if you're in a society that has stopped providing those things as they used to traditionally provide them, right? That's what our society is, and that's why we're seeing this kind of extreme chaos where it seems like you're either, like, you know, a gay fire eater, you know, who performs on the streets and you know, makes videos and is big in Japan.
Yeah.
Or else you're this... you're this radical fundamentalist marching through the streets saying, you know, we must kill the gay fire eaters. And there seems to suddenly be no one in the middle, you know. Of course, there is. We're all in the middle, really. But that to me is, you know, we want to get back into the gray, the gradations of gray. And you know, the book was not written to answer all your questions, and you have a lot of good questions. And I, you know, I don't have the answers to everything. The book is a search. It's really a quest to try to unravel some of these really strange things we're seeing in our society.
I mean, I certainly agree with you that there are microcosms of people who clutch on to pop culture and religion and karaoke like there is no tomorrow and this is the only thing for them. I also, you know, agree with you that there are people who, you know, are traditional conformists, I suppose, as we understand the word. But I guess, you know, it just seems to me that the sort of the arc of the book, you know, I'm again trying to understand the sort of the gray area, the Frankenstein monster, so to speak, of like varying sort of conformist and non-conformist.
Right.
Things. Is this what would be truly special in your opinion or in your view?
I'm not sure what you mean by that.
Well, I mean to say, if like someone makes certain life decisions where they are partially conformist and partially like... partially conformist, non-conformist, and partially conformist.
Right.
You know. Yeah. So this would be like the new special here we're talking
right.
about.
Well, I mean, I'm, you know, I'm not really in I mean, at the end of the day, I'm not that interested in, you know, advising people on how they can achieve specialness, you know. What I am interested in is returning to, you know, humanity, the sanctity of individuality as its own concept.
Sure.
That people should not feel that they have to have a, you know, a blog and a performance and be dating 19 people through the contrivances of, you know, all kinds of internet dating sites and in 19 tattoos to go with it. People shouldn't feel like they have to have all that stuff to find meaning in their life. Neither should they feel like they have to completely submerge their identity in, you know, a religion or a cult that tells them, you know, that provides community in the course of telling them, you know, what to do every single second of their existence. You know, people shouldn't feel like they have to do either of those things. So now we have this great gray area of people who are pulled in both those directions. They want tradition and meaning in their lives. But they don't want oppression, you know. They want a sense of stardom and celebrity, but they don't want complete vacuity and virtual reality. And I think this is the pull we have, and this, so many of us are in this place where it's like, okay, what am I going to do? How am I going to make my meaning in life? How am I going to approach family, community, religion, politics? Everything is touched by this pull. And... you know, again, we live in this society where you have to make your own decision about everything because of this sort of collapse in the center. And most people, you know, navigate this terrain and survive. But at the same time, we see incredibly high rates of depression, anxiety. We see, you know, societies like in Japan where they have, you know, growing rates of suicide. They have the entire shut-in phenomena where teenagers will just go into their room and refuse to leave for 10 years. you know, we have these things in our societies, and I don't think they come out of nowhere. They don't come out of you know, an accident. They come out of this intense confusion.
But you could also look at these particular suicides on a case-by-case basis. Some people might be manic depressives or bipolar. It could be society. It could be nature versus nurture. This gets into sort of like a huge box of tricks here. But more importantly, what I'm trying to sort of get at from you, and to sort of conclude this, is there a bona fide specialness that you can advocate here? I mean,
No, there isn't. The people should not want to be special, and we have to completely eliminate this. We have to reform our conceptions of these ideas, you know, and it starts really with kind of underground versus mainstream, and celebrity versus non-celebrity, and all these kind of conceptions that we have to be blown up. And, you know, a lot of this comes out of freeing the media so that people don't feel like the only way they can get on TV is by lighting themselves on fire, or trekking across the Sahara on their knees. We need to find new ways that we can communicate with each other through what has become natural to us, which is the electronic media. It's natural now for us to talk to people with shared interests in Bolivia and Alaska, as opposed to the neighbor next door who, you know, doesn't share our passion for miniature bowling or whatever, you know. So there isn't a legitimate specialness, because the entire concept is a perversion of humanity, really.
Well, what I guess then, so say, isn't one's identity important then at all? I mean, you know, isn't it enough to sort of like have at least some kind of element that, you know, I did this, but it's, you know, not necessarily a matter of being special, it's a matter of being who you are. Is that kind of what I'm getting at here?
Well, we're getting to the same place, which is basically what I'm saying, is we need to find a way to return our society to a world where you can do something and say, I did that, and that was good.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't do it and then have a press conference and then blog about it and then, you know, and then write a book about it and make a documentary about it.
Well, you wrote a book about this. Are you special?
I mean, right. Well,
you could be accused of the same thing.
Again, we're trapped in this world. Yeah. I mean, what is the way that I can get out an idea? I have to play this media game. I have to do interviews. I have to pose, and I have to, you know, claim specialness.
Yeah.
Because if I don't, then I'm nothing. And then then I'm retreating, right? And I made a decision for myself that, you know, my answer to this problem is not going to be to retreat and have no dealings with society while I write my books. Other people have gone the opposite direction and said, well, there isn't an answer. I don't want to be corrupted, so I'm going to disappear. So I don't think either way is wrong. I'm doing my thing, and part of that thing is talking about in interviews and in the book how this whole process of, you know, being published and being an author and doing interviews, you know, is part of the special phenomenon. To me, is really, you know, invalid and unfortunate.
Well, so basically, the gist here is it's just as long as people are, you know, more or less happy, or at least, you know, not in an absolute sense, but they're more or less, you know, this is what I do, essentially, is basically kind of the answer.
Yeah, if you can find that in yourself and in your community and your society, that's great. The problem is more and more people cannot find that, and, you know, are being, through all kinds of contrivances and forces in our society, are being pushed into this idea that I have to be special. I can't just be what I am. You know, I have to be more than what I am. And that to me is, you know, is a great tragedy. It's something that's fueling a lot of despair and anxiety.
Well, I don't want you to be late to your reading. Hal, thank you so much for talking.
Thank you very much.